Fresh from the Pod.
I'm Tamsin Westsaw, garden writer and gardener. In this episode, I meet naturalist Nick Baker. Nick is a well-known author and TV presenter. He's a man that knows all things insect, bird and animal. And in this podcast, we discuss how to charm the worms, how to enjoy badgers in the garden, and why we should all be growing hedges. And shares a story of how a crocodile once visited his pond.
Right, Nick, it is lovely to meet you. I have brought you a very strange gift. It's a pot of my mother's homemade marmalade. Now, even if you don't like marmalade, I know you'll like the jar.
Well, you're in luck. I like marmalade, and it is a lovely jar, isn't it? The chances are, see, most jars in my house, things get in them, so I use them for pond creatures. This is quite nice because it's got square sides. It's like it's a cube, which makes it a perfect little mini aquarium.
Well, that's what however, I thought.
Very well. However, I think that my wife will probably pinch it if once the marmalade's out of it, because she makes her own jam as well. So that's the way it goes. Recycle.
And your sort of career or passion for insects started with jam jars, didn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've been... It was the wildlife that I could see. So I don't know when it started, but my eyes became dysfunctional sometime in my early... Well, I was probably less than 10 years old when it was discovered I was very short-sighted.
Okay.
So pretty much the animals I could see were the ones that were right in front of my nose. Everything else, everything more than a metre or two away from my head was blurry. So, of course, I was focused on the insects and the invertebrates, all the little creepy crawlies, all those things. So that was my first love in some ways. And when I got glasses, when I finally got diagnosed as being myopic and then got glasses, that's when I started bird watching. So I don't think it was an accident that I started looking at a bigger horizons. But the insects have always stuck with me, and their significance, their ability to excite, inspire, have always amazed me. But what equally amazed me was that other folk didn't seem to see it that way.
Yeah.
It started a bit of a life mission, which I continue to this day, which is to stick up for the underdogs, the animals that people love to hate or don't understand
properly.
And
that we walk on.
Yeah, that we tread on. We don't see it as viable life, which is kind of ironic, really, when you understand that actually life that we know couldn't go on without theirs. So we are balancing on their shoulders.
Yeah. So under your bed, were there boxes of snails? I had a fox's biscuit tin full of snails under my bed. I love collecting the snails.
Yeah, well, the jam jar zoo was very much something which... So I wasn't allowed pets, not regular pets. My mum didn't like cats and dogs and things like that. We had a small hole. We lived on the small holdings. So we had goats and chickens and ducks and all sorts of other things, pheasants and owls and all sorts of other brilliant animals. But things in the house weren't allowed. My mate, I remember his name, Andrew Burgess was his name. He always, his mum let him have goldfish in his bedroom and also stick insects. And I just wasn't allowed that. And I remember pleading with my parents to let me have some stick insects. And they buckled. The local museum was giving away stick insects for free. As we all know, if you've kept stick insects, that is inevitable. Especially if you keep the Indian stick insect, Carosus morosus is its name. And it's the animal which just breeds, pathogenically, so it doesn't need a male. So the females just churn out eggs, hundreds of eggs in their lifetime, which then hatch. Now, I got these stick insects, I made a cage for them, and the cage was some wire hoops with one of my mum's old stockings stretched over the top of it, which worked lovely. And we had it all set up, and then we went away on holiday. And sometime whilst away on holiday, the stocking decided to ladder. Now, how this happens, I don't know, but it had laddered, and all these little freshly hatched stick insects escaped into the house. And that was it. I'd blotted my copybook. I wasn't allowed to keep any pets, no matter what kind, after that point, because these stick insects got everywhere. I mean, they ate the house plants out of desperation. I mean, I normally feed them on privet, but these things were crawling off and nibbling all my mum's prized house plants. And for months afterwards, there'd be stick insects seen on ceilings and walls, and I mean, hundreds of them. So that was it. So everything after that point had to be in the garden. Unfortunately, we had because it was a small holding, we had about an acre of land, and I built a butterfly house in my garden, and I started keeping all my insects and my fish and all those things in the shed and the butterfly house, which
so
was...
So you were a Gerald Durrell of your time.
Kind of. Gerald Durrell inspired me. So Gerald Durrell was definitely one of those people that told me that my new freakish hobby, because it really did evolve into the fascination of everything living and dead. So as a consequence, Gerald Durrell's book, The Amateur Naturalist, which was my Bible as a kid, was... Gerald Durrell was telling me this was all right, you know, whereas everyone else in my life was questioning it all the time. But equally, I had this butterfly house outside. It was all unheated. So it got really warm in the summer, but it was really cold in the winter. So I couldn't keep all the exotic things I wanted to keep. I wanted to keep silk moths in particular. I had a dream of being a butterfly farmer in the 80s when it was very fashionable in the UK. And that involved sort of gardening tropical plants and then and using the understanding of the ecology of the butterflies to culture those within a kind of tropical garden setting. That's what I wanted to do. I wasn't able to do that, so I ended up buying silk moths online and breeding them secretly under my bed. and my mum at this time probably thought my room smelt a little bit musty. But then I was a teenage boy and there
That's
was not
normal.
This. Yes, it's perfectly normal. Yeah, most teenage boys smell a bit musty. And I got away with it. And, you know, my mum sort of kept away from my room, which allowed me to breed these silk moths under the bed. I then expanded into various tarantulas and things like that. Now, my mum was an arachnophobe, so this was a serious thing. If they got out or if she found them, that would be the end of the world. Fortunately, the moment where she discovered the silk moths was the moment when I had a small window of no spiders in my life. So I got away with it to an extent. But I remember one day she just said, right, it's time we sorted out your wardrobe. You've got loads of clothes that don't fit you. And I, at this point, I had Atlas moths in the wardrobe with a big flight cage that's hanging up from a coat hanger in my wardrobe full of Atlas moths, which are, you know, one of the largest moths in the world. And I remember going through all the shirts and then finding this cage. I had my eyes shut. I was just kind of praying, you know, waiting for the shout, the scream, whatever the response was going to be. And then she went, what are these? These are beautiful. What are they? At which point it was like, thank goodness for that. Now, I got a bit confident by her response and I said, I've been breeding them for ages. Do you want to see the rest? And then I pulled all the trays that are underneath my bed out with all the caterpillars and she wasn't so happy about that.
No.
but then I went on and I remember my grandfather... been amazed by all this stuff. We went down to stay with him for the holidays and I had loads of excess cocoons of these moths from which, you know, the silk capsules from which the moths will eventually hatch. I wanted to sell my excess to the local butterfly house and my grandfather drove me there. And he was fascinated by this idea. And then I went in with an ice cream box full of these cocoons and I came out with a roll of cash. And I saw my grandfather decide at that point that it wasn't quite such a freaky hobby. It actually made sense because it had legs. It paid.
Do you think, going back to your mother being scared of spiders, I mean, I'm amazed how many people are scared of spiders. And do you think that's where kids' sort of fear starts when they hear mum screaming? There's a spider in the bath.
I think there's a lot to do with it. There's a conditioning that goes on. Now, I know my mum would have been very careful not to show her fear, but I don't believe, I think we pick up on it whether or not it's been communicated or not. I'm not quite sure why I wasn't scared of spiders in any way, because my mum was terrified. I remember the milkman coming to the door one morning to get the milk money, and my mum reached up. She kept the milk money in a little pot on the shelf, and she went up to pull this pot out, and this house spider ran down her arm into her blouse. My mum was quite a private individual in many ways, and to give an idea how scared of spiders was, I remember her whisking her blouse off to get this spider, and the milkman thought it was his lucky day.
Yeah, I bet.
So she was pretty scared. Later on in life, when I left for university and came down here to the West Country, I made up for lost time and I started breeding all sorts of tarantulas and scorpions, all sorts of exotic things I wouldn't be able to keep as a kid at home. And then when Mum came down to visit, she had no choice but to face her fears. And by the end of it, I got her holding a tarantula. So that was pretty good. It took a long time. It took the best part of a year of very gradual exposure to... first of all, a spider skin, just an empty skin, small skin, because as they grow, they molt their skins like any invertebrate does. And I didn't force her to look at this thing. I just put it on the middle of the room in the table, and she could come in closer when she was ready. And then I just made the skin, got the skins bigger and bigger and bigger until the end she was really, you know, holding a tarantula skin in her hand. So the essence of a tarantula, basically, without the living bit. And then bit at a time, we got to get accustomed to it, made her think about spiders in a different way. So it is possible, but yeah, it's a strange one. It's a lot easier. I just think a lot of our hatred or fear or misunderstanding of invertebrates, whether it's slugs, snails, spiders, ants, whatever it is, taps into the basis of prejudice. You know, it's a lot easier, and we hear it all the time, it's a lot easier to hate something than it is to actually bother to understand it. So if it's not in your immediate sort of bubble of familiarity, it becomes alien.
But gardeners, this is why I really wanted to speak to you, because obviously I spend most of my time on my hands and knees and I see lots of insects and worms and things. You know, how do you think people should be gardening now? Is what's really what I'm interested to know.
Well, I mean, there's lots of different ways of gardening. The way I like to garden is I don't want to be a slave to the garden. My parents were were slaves to gardening in some ways. Yeah. The lawn always had to be cut and the hedges always needed to be trimmed, and a lot of that's rubbed off for me, and I don't like it in myself because it's obviously what I've grown up thinking of normal. So recently, you know, I've been so busy, I don't have time, so I let it go. I've relatively recently discovered that actually I enjoy a wild garden, because if gardening is about tinkering with and manipulating nature to something that's pleasurable to you, then allowing it to be a little freer it's another form of gardening. I get as much pleasure watching, I know, a crab spider in an oxeye daisy, or those little purple and gold pyralid moths that feed on mint. Those give me great pleasure, more so, or as much so, as any bloom or any plant. It's life. And if you are adjusting life around you to make you feel good, because that's ultimately what we're doing, then I think it shouldn't just stop at plants. So I like planting plants that are wild type, so they're not necessarily fancy varieties, which not always, but often have the good bits bred out of them. So
yeah,
the,
I think we're definitely, as gardeners, coming around to single flowers, you know, for the bees, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that seems to be, and then this has been very much in the press recently. We have a responsibility as gardeners, of course. I can't give you the figures, but if you look down on a cityscape and look at all the gardens, that actually represents a significant portion of the habitat. So if we all gardened with a little bit more gently, with a slightly gentle touch, then these gardens not only will give the gardeners a lot more pleasure, but they'll also join up and become corridors in their own way. I've always thought that, you know, my only real experience of real urban areas was my grandparents' house in Croydon, which was, you know, it's pretty suburban. And I remember my grandfather saying when he was a boy, well, this was fields, you know, and all the road names were named after, you know, the dew pond or the wood or and that made me feel really sad as a child, thinking that all this sort of diesel and dust and concrete has covered it all up. But then I looked at all these gardens and I thought, well, if everyone planted, now not this is ever going to happen, but if everyone planted a tree in their garden, then you're not then got a tree in your garden. If everyone did it, you're living in a wood. Mm. Okay, the tree's a bit spaced out, but it'll still be a fairly open plan wood. And straight away, animals and whether it's birds or whatever will be using that wood as a kind of corridor and moving around it. And I just thought, well, that's my dream of gardening, is to be part of something, part of the bigger landscape.
Mm. My biggest bugbear is when people put fence panels up, you know, make their garden into a pen. Desperate for more people to plant hedges, because obviously that would allow hedgehogs to run through. You've got it's like a wildlife corridor, isn't it?
It is, but we live in an instant gratification society. You know, let's face it, the speed with which we acquire knowledge, it's milliseconds now. This idea of working for something is something that the older generations maybe appreciate more than the younger generations. So, yeah, if you want to create a barrier,
it's
nip down to the DIY shop and put a fence and get a few fence panels, and you can do it in an afternoon. Whereas a hedge requires culturing. It requires a bit of knowledge as to what you're going to plant. That information is available in milliseconds on the internet, of course, but it requires a little bit more thinking. And one thing you can't change is the speed at which those plants grow. Even quickthorn, even hawthorn, which is an amazing hedging plant, takes a bit of time to develop into something of any significance. But there's the satisfaction right there, is it? If you know, good things come to those who wait. You sit back, you watch it, you nurture it, and it doesn't take much more than a few seasons, and you'll have a dense, wildlife-friendly hedge, and then you can grow things up through it. You can multi-plant, you can do all that stuff. So for me, the pleasure, it's about gardening. Your plants grow slowly, or some plants do anyway. The whole idea of developing and slowing down, that's what gardens are for. Mm. And I just enjoy that planting for something and waiting for it to arrive as well. That's also one of my pleasures. I lived in Miami for a while, and I had a house, I was given a house effectively there by my ex-mother-in-law. And it was a massive, I mean, it was not a massive house, but it had a large kind of square or rectangle of grass, and that was it. And there was nothing else there. Yeah, I lived effectively in the tropics, you know, there was, or subtropics, and all these amazing animals that before I could only have kept in a heated greenhouse, all those butterflies that I grew up dreaming of breeding, I could effectively breed in my garden. They would be wild.
Heaven for you.
So it was heaven. So the first thing I did, because the first thing any wildlife gardener should do is, and it doesn't matter how big or small your garden is put in some water. So I dug a pond, and it was a sizable pond, and the water table was quite high, so it filled naturally. And running the other side of the fence that demarked the garden was a ditch, and that ditch basically went into another ditch, eventually connected to the Everglades. And within, must have been a month of digging the pond, a gator moved in. And I had a gator in my pond. And it was a dream. No, it was a dream. And I had sliders, had little turtles turn up as well. And they just turned up naturally. And it was great. This gator made life a little bit difficult because in the breeding season, they get very territorial.
I
so
bet.
You couldn't get near the pond. But but that was a nice problem to have because as a small boy, that was a dream. I always wanted, there's a very rare swallowtail there called the pipe vine swallowtail. And I really wanted it. And I looked up, what does it feed or what does it need as a larval food plant, which is another way of thinking about gardens, is don't just think of the flowers, the pretty things, because obviously you like looking at pretty things, we like looking at pretty things, and that's the flower. But also the insects want nectar on them. But butterflies like the nectar, and bees will like the nectar, but you need more if you want the full satisfaction. If you want the development of the life cycle within your garden, you need to provide for that. Mm. So anyway, I planted pipe vine. It's a vine. I planted it along the fence, and I had pipe vine swallowtails within the week. We had lots of heliconid butterflies, which is a very beautiful little thing that feeds on passion flower. And of course, passion flowers are freaky flowers, and I like sticking up for weird things. And there's also lots of different species, lots of varieties. So I got some wild type passion flowers and grew them. And within, a week or so, before the things even got established, you know, I literally dug a hole, took them out of the pot, popped them in. Before they even got going, in fact, I had to take some of the newly hatched caterpillars off and put them on other passion flowers, which I had to buy in because they were, in risk of being eaten to pieces
so
by these caterpillars.
What you're saying is we should buy things. Well, if you've got an insect in mind that you want, you've got to plant for it.
Assuming they're in the area, and if they're not in the area, that there has to be a species that can move.
So there's no way that I'm going to get a croc in my pond at home.
Not without interfering considerably with things. But no, they wouldn't do very well. That's the one thing about living in the UK. You don't have any really big reptiles, but you could garden for frogs and toads. You could garden for common lizards. You could garden for grass snake. And if you're in the right place and you're lucky enough, you could garden for adder. And I know that sounds really, to a lot of people, it goes straight back to that prejudice thing.
Yeah.
Adder, it's our only venomous snake. It's dangerous. I mean, the reality of it is you've got to have a fairly wild garden to have adder. But to be honest with you, grass snakes is quite a garden-friendly snake in many ways, especially if you keep a compost heap. If you keep a nice hot compost heap with lots of grass cuttings on, grass snakes rather, will move in fairly quickly. And of course, they add to the the beauty and the fascination of the garden. But, you know, I do get grass snakes pass through my garden. I say pass through. I've never seen them resident other than the little newly hatched ones. They stick around for a few weeks. But I've got common lizards and I've got slow worms. And, you know, they give me great pleasure, especially in spring when they come out of hibernation and they sit on the walls and sunbathe themselves.
Now, you might be able to solve this. We've got 5 beehives in my garden.
Ooh,
and they're looked
you.
After by a beekeeper who's a friend of mine. Now, I clean out the bird bath regularly. I'm a bit paranoid about it because they look lovely and I love seeing the birds pushing around. And he said, don't clean them so much because bees like dirtier water. Is that true? I've never heard it before.
I've never heard that. I mean,
I'm not going to
don't get into trouble, but no, I can't see why that would be. It may be they don't like tap water, but then a day in a bird bath, any of the chemicals in our tap water will disperse. So that can't be the problem. And if you're worried about that, then as a good gardener, you should be harvesting your own rainwater. So use rainwater anyway. I mean,
good,
it's better for the plants. So I don't think there's a problem there. But also that's part of another beauty of something as simple as a bird bath is it's not just the birds that use it. You know, and I love on a really hot summer's day watching, the honeybees come in. I don't keep bees.
They line up.
They line up. They queue up and they fill their crop with water and they take it back to the and the wasps will do it as well. Quite a lot of insects will do it actually, so it's quite nice to see that.
But as gardeners, we are completely paranoid about the pest, aren't we?
Yes.
We sort of have books published, garden pests,
how to squash them.
So where do you stand with that? I mean, I'm of the inclination that okay, if I'm growing lupins, I'm going to have green fly, but I'll get the ladybirds. And then if I really don't want green fly, I won't grow the lupins. But would you ever class an insect as a pest?
Usually pest means it's when an animal gets established. So you've created a resource. The first things to come in are the herbivores. And that could be your lupins and suddenly you get your green. So you plant lupins, you get the green fly in. And they'll have a party initially. And their numbers will rise. It might take a year or two and your lupins may never reach that, their full potential because of that. But then there comes a point where when you've got an excess of prey species, you then attract the equivalent you then attract the predators. So I always think it's like the African plains. You can't have your gazelle and your zebra. You can't have your lions without your gazelle and zebra. And it's the same with gardens. These herbivores, which are the things that tend to compete directly with what we're trying to do in a garden when we're growing plants, are the resources that something else will harvest. And so, you need to be patient again. It's that patience thing. Yeah. It's like, give it a chance. It is frustrating. I mean, I lose loads of stuff every year. And it changes by the year. You might get a really damp year and all the slugs come out and eat things. But then there's tricks there as well. So it's not as simple as kill all the slugs. It's like, well, actually, maybe you've been too tidy. Maybe you've taken away all the things that the slugs would prefer to eat. So most slug species, not all, but most slug species will feed primarily on dead or decaying leaves or vegetation. So if you're one of those people that deadheads things and takes all the leaves off from around the base of a plant for fear of it harboring pests, which is, you might actually ironically be removing the thing that the slugs and snails will want to be feeding on, and they'll then move on to the actual plant itself. And it's really frustrating. I mean, there are years where I curse the slugs and the snails, but then that's the part of the challenge is to, you have to tinker with it. But the answer isn't to then scatter slug pellets everywhere or using weed killers or herbicides. I just don't use it. That's my rules to myself. Don't use any of that stuff. And therefore, the challenges are to live with nature. That's the thing. Work with it. And if you are still losing the fight, then you have to think about which predators would help you win the fight. And maybe you're not providing the right habitat for them. You know, there might be food there, but maybe they need something else. And that's what, providing for, lacewings and hoverflies and the ladybirds, all those species, they require other things in the environment. And the more diverse and interesting you can make your garden, and the more habitats you can create, the bigger the buffer between you and a pest epidemic, I guess.
But if you wanted to sort of send a child out into the garden to explore and find things and see things, What time of day would you do that? Because I know in my rural garden, as it gets to dusk, it's brilliant. I used to lie on my son's trampoline and look, and all these bats would be going over. I used to lie there with him and go, just be quiet. Yeah, and they'd be flying, and then you'd hear the owl. Is that the right time?
It's just all the time. I mean, there's like time shifts going on all through the day. I mean, you've got this kind of, going on all through the day where animals are specifically active at different times of the day. Some of the insects are sun lovers, so they are thermally induced to be active. So, we're talking the bees and the butterflies. They like the middle of the day, hoverflies, or the wasps, all those things. Then you've got the bumblebees will be active all through the day, but because of the way they're designed to run at cold temperatures. So the whole reason a bumblebee's fuzzy and fat is because it is insulated against the cold. And what they do is they've got a special trick up their sleeves or up their thorax, which is they effectively dislocate their wings and then vibrate their flight muscles. So if you see a cold bee, you'll see it sort of throbbing and its abdomen's sort of pumping backwards and forwards. And what it's doing is it's flying without flying. It's pumping its muscles backwards and forwards and generating metabolic heat to get its body temperature up to, 30, 35 degrees or whatever it is, and then it can fly. So bumblebees are designed to exploit the cooler ends of the day and also cooler parts of the season as well. So the early bumblebees, some of the first insects you'll see active in the spring will be the bumblebees because they are tolerant of the cool. And then if you look geographically, bumblebees, you don't get many bumblebees in the tropics. So bumblebees are very much a temperate insect. So they're super adapted to that. So it depends what you want to go out. But at night, there's lots of advantages to exploring the garden at night, partly because doing anything at night, walking, it takes something that's quite familiar to you and it changes it completely. So even a simple little walk, your daily constitutional, if you take one, can be revolutionized by going out at night because it all changes. One, you'll see more. Because you'll see things you wouldn't see during the day because different animals are active in the evenings. Crepuscular, so just in that sort of dimsy light between day and night, dusk and dawn, animals are active then. But then there's other species that are active in the dark bit in the middle. And also activity changes with the moon cycle. So straight away, there's a whole world, half of our life we're missing if we're not going out at night and exploring. And gardening at night, and you're making a night garden, is a really exciting thing. So one of my favourite things are these, and I think they're called a night-scented phlox.
Oh, yes.
I don't think it's a true phlox, but it's a beautiful thing. All the ones I've kept have told me it's an annual, but I've managed to keep them going for multiple years by bringing them in.
Because you live in this wonderful, balmy county of Devon.
Well, but they sit on the seed packet. That's not possible. Anyway, so I managed to keep these things going, but it's one of my favourite plants because I put it in little places where the air kind of stagnates, so up close to the house, near the windows and stuff, and it is gorgeous. And jasmine is another one. I love it. Some people think it's a bit sickly. Privet's another one. Let your privet hedges flower. That's a battle I have every year with my hedge, is that I want to keep it tight so the birds have got somewhere to nest. So I have to cut it. But the time where it looks its most untidy, if tidy is a word we even want to use as a gardener, is when it's about to flower. And I like the flowers more than I like a tidy hedge. So I let it go really bushy. I let the flowers open up. And then at night, it's humming with moths. And that scent is just something else.
It's interesting you've mentioned hedges because some people would say, oh, you shouldn't cut hedges. But I'm with you, really, that you need to keep them tight. Otherwise, they're not a hedge anymore.
No, it becomes a tree. I mean, all you're doing with a hedge is suppressing the plant's natural... I mean, that's what gardening is. It's tinkering with nature. And most hedge plants become trees or shrubs. Mm. So if you let it go, you lose the function of a hedge. Which is a stock proof or privacy barrier. And this goes back to, hedge laying. Before we use fences, electric fences or barbed wire fences, hedges were the only way of doing it. It was the materials you had at hand and it was a cheap way of doing it. And also by chance, they happen to be wildlife friendly and good corridors. And that's a whole different issue. If you're talking about gardening with hedges, that's a big landscape wide issue. There is always a compromise. I mean, privet, when I moved into the house I'm in now, the hedge was hadn't been cut for 4 or 5 years. And one, you couldn't see anything through it at all. I couldn't see the views. I couldn't see out of this. It was very claustrophobic. So I spent several years just cutting it down bit at a time. So it got to a height that allowed me to see a vista outside of the garden. But in doing so, my sparrow population went up because they had a nice, you know, there's a lot of studies that have been done that, you know, because our house sparrow, of course, is a red listed bird. It's declined massively in the last 20 years. And one of the things that is fueling this decline is not only the lack of food and the fact we've tidied up everything, but is that hedges have become a rarer thing. So if you've got, if you feed your garden birds and you've got hedges, then
you're doing well. What about the pet cat? Dare I mention it?
Oh, this is a controversial one.
go easy.
Yeah. Well, I'm stuck. Yeah, I mean, I live in a street where nearly everyone has a cat except for me, which then means my garden is the war zone between all the territory. It becomes the toilet, which is something that I just hate. I hate cat scat in the garden, especially when you're barefoot hanging the washing up. If you do use it, I have a battle with my wife all the time. My wife loves machines. She loves strimmers and things like that, and I hate them. I like scythes.
She needs to take up scythes. And, really,
well, the one thing that put her off the strimming is the fact that when you hit some cat droppings with a strimmer, it's not a very pleasant experience. So there's that, but there's the other side, which is the cats are significant predators. We are basically, we have a native cat, which is an endangered species. It's now restricted to Scotland. Severely threatened by feral cats, which are inbreeding with it. So that's one issue. The other issue, and an argument I often hear cat people, if we can make that simple demarcation, I know we can't, but people who like cats will often say, yes, but there's a native species. You know, we effectively have cats in the landscape.
My cat doesn't kill birds.
Yeah, or my cat doesn't kill birds. These are all arguments I hear quite a lot. I've never met anyone who's had a cat that says, yeah, my cat kills everything. But what it is for me, you are keeping, if you're looking at the landscape through a sort of an ecologist's eyes, you're keeping predators at a really high density, a density that was far exceed what cats would have been in the landscape. So that's the first problem. And also they will take, and some individuals don't, I appreciate that, but some will, and they will take, it's millions of birds every year. But not just birds, they'll take small mammals. I had a friend of mine who's an entomologist who lost loads of really rare dragonflies as they visited his pond to his cat butterflies, all these things. So cats, I don't think, go hand in hand with a wildlife garden, not if you want to do it completely properly. But equally, I appreciate that, you know, I don't want to put people off. It's a terribly sensitive area. I mean, it is a really difficult thing. You know, there's this idea of a house cat. I'm not sure I agree with that either. So I just think it needs to be considered if you're buying cats, is to think about the effect and influence it'll have, not just on your neighbours, but also on your local wildlife species.
I could have done with a cat though. On Wednesday, had BT out, my internet wasn't working, and a mouse had eaten through the cable.
Oh dear, yes.
Oh, I was cursing that mouse. But I mean, I live rurally, so mice, they don't bother me. It's just part of
it is, where and again, they find a balance as well. You know, I've got a mouse problem because I've got a mouse problem because I've got a badgers, and I love my badgers, and my badgers will often.
But in your garden?
Yeah, I have them come to my door. Gosh. Every night. In fact, in some day they've become my waste disposal unit, and I know it's not cool to admit it, but I confess I do feed my badgers. But what they do is if I forget to put the food out, occasionally they will turf the lawn. But that's part of it. Doesn't
what,
take more
anger.
They eat the worms and the cockchafer beetles, which technically are also an agricultural pest. So they're doing their bit for the balance. But occasionally they'll break into the shed. I've got a few badger shaped
like
holes.
A cartoon. You need to write a kid's book and get them like made into cartoon characters.
Well, I've got over 20 different individuals of badger individuals using my garden. But they will break into my shed and they'll turn over the bird food bins. And then, of course, they spill everything. They eat everything. And then, of course, the mice eat everything. There was scraps left over. But the badger was actually a really important part of my gardening, because we, as in my wife and I, decided we were going to keep chickens at one point.
Oh, yes, I've been there.
And we got some rescue chickens, which was, dare I say, a mistake, because they laid initially, because they are, you know, ex-farm hens or battery farm hens. And it was lovely to give them a better life for a very short window of time. They gave us some eggs as a thank you. And then they just stopped. They just gave in. And
exhausted,
they just became very expensive. Yeah, they were very expensive pets. So I was just shoveling corn and into them. And they weren't really doing much.
And did you get rats?
Well, I had rats as well. Well, I've got rats anyway, because several other neighbours have got chickens, and I feed the birds. So there's all sorts of things there. But the badgers turned up. It was quite an interesting day. I'd come back from work. I'd been away filming. And my wife says, I've got good news and bad news. And I said, what is it? She goes, good news, we've got badgers. It was like, oh, brilliant, because you knew. Badgers are very important part of my life. And I grew up with watching badgers in Sussex when I lived with my parents. So badgers, I've always wanted them in my life. And where I live now, they just weren't close by. You know, they were up in the woods and up in the hills, but they weren't in our gardens, so I thought. So when she announced we had badgers, I was thrilled, because, you know, that's another animal in my garden. And then she said, well, the bad news is we don't have chickens anymore. And I said, what do you mean? Well, the badgers had gone in and they'd just eaten all the chickens in one night. So I lost all my chickens to the badgers, which sort of, well, ended my chicken phase of my life. They were all pleasantly recycled into the larger ecosystem. Saved me the uncomfortable decision of what to do with the chickens.
Precisely.
And to be honest with you, I know badgers don't lay eggs, but they give me a lot of pleasure nonetheless. And to have the badgers moving through every night is rather wonderful. And then that meant that I started putting trail cameras up in the garden, which is another little bit of technology which has revolutionized my life. Not only to watch the badgers and identify the individuals, but then I got to know the cubs, and I got to know there's also foxes that are passing through my garden that I didn't know about. And of course, they're really lovely as well.
I mean, aren't we lucky? If you were an entomologist, you know, 100 years ago, you'd have had sketchbooks, you'd have been drawing, wouldn't you, what you
see? Yeah.
And
I still
now,
do.
Well, oh, do you? Now you can just sort of photograph them, film them.
Yeah.
We're getting into their secret lives, aren't we?
Yeah, then you can bung up your hard drive with millions of pictures of badgers from different angles, which is pretty much what I do.
So you do draw, do you?
Yeah, I do. I sketch them. I'm slightly only retentive when it comes to my badger ID. So I put together like a photo fit of the badger faces. They all got a very different shape face. Their stripes go slightly different.
Them.
Yes, they've all got names.
Right.
Some of them have got scars that are very distinctive. Some of them have scars on their nose. So the badger's nose is black, but sometimes you've got like pale scars on it. So you can see shapes in that, like a Rorschach test. So you can kind of come up with, you can name them after, you know, I've got one that's got a scar that looks like a leaf, and another one looks like the Harry Potter lightning strike. So all those things give them their names. Fluffy ears. I've got those with funny tails. So you often need, there's a couple of individuals that are brother and sister that have very similar faces. Until they mature, the males develop a very different shape head. But until they mature, they're quite difficult. Until they turn around and the tails are completely different shapes. But also, he's always got this really weird bald patch in the middle of his tail. So he's got this, looks like a bottle brush. So you get to know them. And I've got these photo fits that show the heads, their back ends, and their claws. And that's how I... And it's one of the pleasures I get out of my garden. If we're talking about gardening, that's as pleasurable as waiting for the roses
and
to burst, you know?
Now we're heading into winter. Most people don't really notice that they've had animals in the garden until we have snow and they see
all the footprints. Yeah. Well, gosh, we don't get much snow, of course, down here in the West Country. When we do, the first thing I do is I go running about, and because it gives me clues all over the place as to what's living where, what's using that hole in the wall, all the rest of it. So it's all part of the pleasure for me.
So why do you live here? Is there, because obviously you're very well travelled, you've just got back from Australia, you've got what looks like a wonderful Crocodile Dundee hat there
on the table. Yes, it is an Akubra. I love it. I like an Akubra.
So why this part of the world? Is this rich enough here in wildlife for you? Because obviously you've seen some incredible places and some incredible animals.
If someone took my passport away today, as much as there's areas of the world I'd miss, because I'm currently falling in love with Australia in a big way, but if I couldn't travel, it wouldn't be the end of the world at all. In fact, in some ways, if it wasn't for the fact that I work for companies that carbon offset, I struggle with the ethics of travel anyway. But we've got so much good stuff in our own country.
Yeah.
And it is incredibly diverse. I mean, I moved here to the West Country because, again, goes back to the butterflies, my early passion for butterflies, which is how I started, really. I used to go out and I used to watch the butterflies. I used to catch them in a butterfly net and I used to bring them back to my butterfly house. Some did better than others, it has to be said. But these are all lessons to learn. We live in this very PC world where we don't allow children to make mistakes.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask.
Pulling
actually.
The wings off flies and things like that. I did it all, yeah. And it's awful. But then I learned very quickly how horrible it was. Mm. And I taught myself, all the values of life by poking around in nature. A big confession. I remember when my parents wouldn't let me have my own pets, I took it into my own hands, and there were some sparrows that nested in the chicken house. And I decided I wanted to have a pet sparrow. So very naively, and I was very young at the time, I remember raiding a nest of sparrows and then building another nest for them in my space and trying to keep them alive. And my dad had watched me from a distance, going backwards and forwards behind the sheds with things, thinking, what's he up to? He found me there one day, sort of like, with basically a nest full of dead sparrows, and I was in tears, and he was really, really cross with me. But he didn't have to be, because I'd already taught myself a lesson.
But you see, years ago, people would have collected eggs, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And they would have learned what they looked like.
Yeah, my dad's generation were very much egg collectors.
So your father's, they would have known, right, that's a blue-tit egg, that's a robin's egg. We don't know that. And I think, yes, we definitely shouldn't be going around collecting
them. I agree,
But when you speak to people like my mother, she used to go out on nature walks at school and they would draw what they see. We just don't do enough of that, do we?
Yeah, we live in a world where don't touch, partly because, there's this idea that it's all, it can all get you. It's poisonous or it'll bite you. And there's the don't touch because it's rare. So I was brought up and told not to pick the flowers. But I remember also having this conversation with David Bellamy. I was lucky to work with him many years ago. And the only reason David Bellamy became a really good botanist was because he would pick flowers for his mum on the way back from school, present them to her, and she would make him identify them all.
Yeah.
And with that comes a knowledge. And that knowledge is becoming more and more distant. And I would argue we're doing more harm to the natural world by creating these barriers than... and therefore creating a generation that doesn't value nature.
Because you go into schools a lot, don't you? And you work with kids.
I do, yeah.
What reaction do you get? You must come across kids that have never, picked a worm up.
It's happening all the time. I was working with the Wildlife Trusts there for a school. I am there for a school ambassador. I went to a school somewhere in the Midlands, and I was talking to the kids about identifying trees, which is the easy place to start, because they don't run off. And I'm always amazed how many people don't, not just kids, the parents of the kids, the teachers of the kids don't know their trees anymore. Because we don't need to know, because we don't make the tools, we don't make tool handles. Most of us don't make fires anymore. We don't need to know which wood burns better. So there's a whole, there's people listening to this podcast who will be saying, well, that's not true. I always make, but I'm talking about overall. If you're looking at percentage of the population in the UK that actually make a fire, cut their own wood to make a fire.
It's very low.
Very, very low. So that knowledge is gone. And I was sitting there talking to them about these trees and, showing them the difference between, I think it was a hawthorn leaf and an oak leaf, and then explaining the tree and the different structure of the tree, and therefore the different uses it has, but also the different habitats and the different foods it provides for wildlife, so the biodiversity it supports. And then this scream went out, and I couldn't work out what was going on. They were all sort of stampeding away, and it's a worm. It was quite a cold spring day, and they had been sort of jumping up and down on the spot, and a worm had come up through the ground. And they freaked out about this worm. And it turned out none of them had touched a worm before.
Oh, my goodness. I think I've probably eaten it.
So I got this worm, and I said, no, come back. And then I got them to look at the worm, understand the worm, feel the worm, run their fingers backwards down the worm so they could feel the little seti, the little bristles. The bristles that make a worm very difficult to pull out the ground. So when you see a blackbird pulling on a worm, the reason it's not coming easily is because it's...
They're fighting back.
They're swelling up their body because they've got a hydrostatic skeleton effectively. So they pump liquid or blood, in this case, down to the bottom and form an anchor. But at the same time, their whole body has got these backward pointing little bristles which lock into the burrow. And if you put a worm, which looks lubricious and squishy, if you put it on a piece of paper, it makes scratchy noises, which is brilliant. Yeah, it's a shame we don't have withers. It makes brilliant podcast material because you can hear them sort of scratching away. So that was it. So I got them fascinated by worms, and I said, "Well, have you ever charmed a worm?" And they were like, "Didn't know what I was talking about." I said, "Right, everyone, jump up and down on the spot, and the worms will come up through the grass," because that's what you've pretty much done. That's why that worm came up in the first place. So we got them all jumping up and down, and they were just fascinated by all these worms that are just pouring out of the soil all around them. And then I talked about, you know, I showed them that there's lots of animals, even if they didn't like worms, and there were some that really weren't going to be convinced. I said, there's other things that do. So the birds, the badgers, the hedgehogs, the frogs, the toads, lizards, all these things will be feeding on the worms. So just because you don't like them doesn't mean that there's not other things that you appreciate and value that don't. So it was a really lovely little lesson. And by the end of it, they felt empowered. They felt they had a little special little trick, a little bit of knowledge of their environment.
They'll be jumping up and down.
Yeah, well,
right
I
now.
Worry a little bit for the worms in that particular playground now because they'll never have a moment's peace. But the point is, we made contact with a very lowly species to some people, but one that is vital to the health of gardens and lawns and soils, wherever you are in the world.
So you've written a book a couple of years ago now called Rewild, and that's to get this sort of message out there, isn't it? We just need to reconnect.
Yeah, it's a bad title for that book, really, because you say Rewild, and people think of bears and wolves and lynx and all the rest of it. The book was actually... It was going to be a foraging book. The publishers asked me to write a book on foraging and wild food, which is the ultimate connection with nature. If you can forage and live off the land, then you are doing well.
Which we all used to do.
Yeah. So it's a way of connecting to the innate hunter-gatherer that's in all of us. But as I started writing the introduction, I just started thinking, well, actually, it's not about... We need to know what we're foraging. We need to connect with what we're looking for. At the same time, I mean, they give you an incentive to identify something if you can eat it, but most of us are a step away from that. So the introduction just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and became the whole book. And really, it's about rewilding ourselves. It's about using the tools that most of us have at our disposal. Most of us were born with these amazing senses and abilities, but don't use them. So, how to use your ears, how to use your sense of smell, even taste, how to... eyes are obviously... we are a visual monkey, so using your eyes properly is something rather special. And there's nothing more empowering than taking people out of an artificially lit night. Give them 45 minutes to let their eyes accustom to the dark. You don't need torches, and just go for a night walk without torches. And it is possible. Okay, you can't see all the details, and you do ideally need to start on a moonlit night on a nice full moon with a clear sky. But you'd be amazed. You almost feel like a superhero. You can see so much more with your eyes than you imagine. But of course, because we live in this artificial bubble where every space we've had is lit, we don't generally see that side of the world. We don't quite literally don't see that side of the world. So for me, it's little tricks like that. It's about empowering yourself to be at one with nature without it sounding too hippie, but it's about engaging and connecting. When you engage and connect, you then start understanding. When you start understanding, and you start valuing, and that's the basis of conservation ultimately. And most of the wrongs I see committed on nature every day have their root in ignorance, and I see it all the time. And all you do, and that's what my life's all about really, is hopefully opening people's eyes to a different perspective on the world. If you're a gardener, that can be anything. I mean, it can be everything from worms all the way through to your telescoping generations of aphids and seeing beauty in that. That's the other thing. They may appear to be the things that are eating the things that you want to grow there, but get you, past that,
yeah,
get over that.
If you watch them, I was sitting on the floor weeding last summer, and this little sort of line of ants, and I thought, where are they going? And it's amazing if you could just take the time to
just follow them. And I mean, that takes me back to where I started. It was this idea of this little world that I lived in. I remember my nan couldn't really understand why I spent all this time on the patio just watching the ants, you know, going backwards and forwards and dismembering crane flies and watching the ants carrying bits of it off.
It's
and,
fascinating.
And it is, and in doing that, I'm a great believer in experiential learning as well. So yes, we live in the internet age. It's very easy to Google anything, you're just getting secondhand information. Mm. And there's something really satisfying about gaining that information yourself. A lot of the details you can see in your garden, you can't get in books. Mm. It's like you don't see these things.
You know, you experience... I watched a clip and you were in a cave <uh-oh>. somewhere and it was so dark... What were you looking for? It terrified me. I thought, gosh, this man's an explorer.
Yeah.
It was like darker than dark.
Oh, that was the Ulm. I was looking for a salamander, an aquatic blind cave salamander, the world's largest troglodyte, which is an animal that can only live in caves. And it's the Ulm. It's in Slovenia. I guess I am an explorer. But those journeys, those explorations, are all about pushing you out of your comfort zone. And that particular film you saw was pushing me out of my comfort zone because I was left underground, 4 kilometres underground without a torch.
How long were you there for? Because you didn't really know.
No, they took my watch away and they took they took my torches away. The only light I had was a low light camera that I could use if I felt like doing something. I terrified myself. I didn't think I was scared of the dark until I made that film. It was like death. I mean, Redmond O'Hanlon, the famous author and explorer, had this thing which was when everything was going wrong, whether you were scared, you would curl up and go to sleep. And he called it the heroics of doing nothing. And I had signed up to that fully at this point because I remember as soon as I realized the crew left me, my imagination started going wild because I'm sitting there in the dark and I'm imagining all these things. I can hear all these noises.
It's my worst nightmare.
I can hear all this dripping. And you know how a dripping tap's annoying? Well, a million dripping taps all at the same time drives you nuts. So I tried to sleep, but I couldn't. I was terrified. And I started hearing what I thought were voices. I was convinced the crew were hiding around the corner. I went looking for them. They weren't there. And the mountain that I was in was effectively breathing. So the wind air pressure changes outside and air circulates through this cave and there's an underground river there. All sorts of weird things going on. So I freaked myself out. But that is part of feeling alive.
Yeah.
And exploring, the definition of exploring is to push yourself out of a comfort zone. And if that means, as a gardener, accepting something, you know, that you wouldn't normally accept or you've been trained not to accept, then that is, you're exploring a possibility. I think that's why you've got physical exploration, like turning over stones and poking around in ponds and doing all that stuff. But then you've also got the just testing things out. Let's face it, all good gardening is about experimenting. It's like, give it a go. Definitely. Plant those seeds. Find
and
out
failure.
If you can grow. Yeah, take some cuttings. Don't be scared of failure. I mean, that's how you learn. I'm not a brilliant gardener by any means, but I love getting stuff for free. So cuttings, I love taking cuttings. And I will, once I get going, I'll take hundreds of cuttings.
And
it's free plants. And if they're nectar rich, if they're plants that provide nectar, I'm really into my my herbs in particular, because they're useful at multiple levels. And I will grow those. And most of them grow really well from cuttings. And then... you can never have too many, because if you've got more than you need, give them away.
They're
brilliant. They're the best present you can give, because we live in a world where getting hold of presents is easy. Mm. In fact, so easy, you don't really have to invest much effort other than, you know, going online and clicking a few buttons, and you can get it delivered and wrapped. Where's the fun in that? And as someone receiving that, where's the fun in that? I'd much rather be given a plant that's been nurtured and looked after by somebody. And it's like your jar of marmalade. You know, that's a proper gift. Whereas actually, I'm assuming you're actually giving it to me, and it's not just a prop.
I am, most definitely. I need to hear how you got on with the marmalade.
But it is. It's one of those things, and that's one of the beautiful things about gardening is that it gives you loads of experiences, but equally you can generate from your learning excess, which you can then swap or give to other people. And that's, it's a community. And that's another thing that's missing in the world. So gardening opens up community as well.
Oh, the conversations that people have.
Yeah, and the crackpot theories we've all got as to how to make things work. I love all that stuff. But that's how we used to work. And in our modern bubble, our modern technological society, that's the value of that seems to be weakened, and allotments are, or gardens and gardening or garden sales are a really good way of breaking down some of those artificial barriers we've created for ourselves. It's a lovely way to go.
Career and life you've got. What's next for you? What's the big dream?
I don't really have a big dream. I mean, everyone says, what do you want to do? And it's like, I want to carry on doing what I'm doing. I accidentally got into the broadcasting. That really was something that I was just following my nose. I grew up in East Sussex. I moved to the West Country for university. But I watched butterflies go extinct as a child in East Sussex. And as a butterfly fanatic, I hadn't really... The West Country was kind of legendary because a lot of the butterflies that are disappearing through the slightly more intensified agricultural landscapes of the southeast were still okay in the West Country. There were still populations of them thriving here. So even though I chose the university down here in Exeter to go to, the reality was it wasn't the university course I was choosing. I was choosing the location because it got me to a place where the butterflies were. And my first job on leaving university after I did a year on the dole was to start working on a very rare butterfly, the high brown fritillary. And I got that job again by complete accident, had to be in the right place at the right time, managed to sell my practical skills because back in those days, CVs were typed with a typewriter. Computers and word processing weren't really something you did. And it was a long, you know, I wasn't particularly good at this, and you know, many versions were torn out of the typewriter before I got the one I was happy with. And as I was about to fold it up and put in with the job application, I realised I hadn't put some information, so I handwrote on it, P.S. I can find the eggs of the purple emperor butterfly.
But I'm no good with a typewriter.
Yeah, but I'm no good with a typewriter. And many years later, after I'd become established field assistant to the Conservation Office of Butterfly Conservation, which is a charity, I was doing some filing as the Saturday boy, and I found my job application. And two of my butterfly heroes, a guy called Martin Warren and Matthew Oates, had both ringed that little handwritten aside, and someone had written in the border, "I think we found our man." So it's little stuff like that, those seemingly useless skills I developed as a child, playing around in the woods and fields and the park and all the rest of it, were actually starting to pay off. So that was the first job, and it just grew from there. And I just set up a club for kids at university called the Bug Club, which was the youth wing of the Royal Entomological Society of London, which is a very grand organisation, very academic. I'm now a fellow of that particular organisation. But the Bug Club was all about getting kids involved with nature. And both of those things happened to be about the right, occurred at the same time. And I got spotted and I got shoved in front of a camera, and the rest is history.
And so we are here at BBC Plymouth, and you're going to do some voiceover.
I'm just about to do a voiceover for a local film, yeah, but I'm very jet lagged because I literally got back from Australia 2 days ago, so I'm very jet lagged, but I'm going to get that done. And
then you can go and have marmalade on toast.
I will. I'll trundle back over the moor, over Dartmoor, where I live, and have my marmalade on toast and start again tomorrow.
It's been an absolute joy to meet you, and I think you're inspirational. You know, I hope lots of gardeners listen to this and just think twice about what they're doing in their plot.
I hope so.
Thanks,
I hope so. Well, thank you very much for finding the time, and thanks for the marmalade.
Okay, enjoy.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Nick Baker, and I hope he enjoys my marmalade. I learnt so much from Nick. His passion is infectious. In the next episode, I talk to Joe Ruxton, founder of PlasticOceans.uk and director of the very important and moving documentary, A Plastic Ocean. And I'm going to be talking to her about what gardeners can do to save our oceans and all society as a whole. Fresh from the Pod is presented by me, Tamsin Westhorpe, and produced by Candide in their plant-filled Bristol office.
Candide is a free plant and gardening app with a helpful community of plant lovers, interesting articles and great tools like plant identification and garden tours. Ask a question in the app with the hashtag #FreshFromThePod and I'll choose my favourite to answer later in the series. And if you enjoyed Fresh from the Pod, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, share it on Reddit and talk about it with your friends. And don't forget to subscribe.